Du bräuchtest doch so eine Klappe. Und Action. Okay, hello and welcome everybody to the next lecture of Architectures of Supercomputers. Today we will be talking about caches and nothing else. So, last week I said that we have basically three ways of structuring caches, which are known as direct mapping, fully associative mapping, and N-way associative or set associative mapping. And I also said last week that this is basically the only way to structure a cache, and the former two are special cases of the N-way associative mapping. And this week we'll try to figure out why that is. Okay, but before we explain the third type to structure a cache, we will start with the former two because they are simpler to understand. And another way to express N-way set associative mapping is to mix the former two, direct placing and fully associative. So, what does direct mapping mean? Basically, when I have a huge block, when I have a lot of memory, and I subdivide my memory into what I call cache lines. And I have, so this is memory. And here is my cache. My cache is also structured into cache lines of the same size. So I have to figure out which cache line in the memory could be placed where. The reason why we would like to keep this placement simple is searching in the cache might be expensive. So maybe a simple way of putting cache lines into the cache is sufficient. And the most simple way we can do this is the direct mapping, where we simply take the main memory address and compute modulo the size of the cache. Modulo does not sound like a cheap function because it involves basically a division. And we learned in the last weeks that divisions are always slow. But usually the size of a cache is a power of 2. And divisions by a power of 2 in the binary coding system are always cheap because I simply cut off some bits and there's nothing that gets cheaper than throwing away bits, right? So what I do is I just look at the main memory address, I chop off some bits, and then I get the cache line where to place my data. Right now we're just trying to preview what each strategy does. We will take a more in-depth look on the next slides. Okay, so this is basically an illustration that I just have drawn on the map. What's important here is that if you go through main memory, you will always see the same pattern of cache lines to which the blocks in main memory correspond. So this here will belong to the same cache block as this one, and so on. So it repeats, which sounds maybe bad because it's so predictive, and you would assume that there will be many cache collisions. But in reality, it works surprisingly well. Okay, so in a fully associative cache, we don't have to compute these modulo we don't have to do these modular calculations because each block may be placed anywhere within the cache. And as I said before, in this case, when I'm trying to look up data in the cache, I have to search all cache lines, and this may be expensive. So I need a lot of hardware, and it might need a lot of time. Now, somehow my PowerPoint is really slow. Okay, so as I said before, pretty much any block can belong to any other cache line. So the N-set associative mapping is a combination of the previous two strategies. So what I do is I don't take my whole cache and let every cache line or every block from main memory sit anywhere, but I will subdivide it into sets. And the mapping now consists of first a modulo computation where I decide in which cache block my main memory address will belong to, and then in that block I have multiple cache lines where the mapping is fully associative. I'm waiting for PowerPoint. Ah. I'm always unsure if this is an animation, which I probably shouldn't skip, or if it's just slow. Anyway, so what I just try to say is, if I have a block here in main memory, this should be the size of cache line, and I have a two-way associative cache, then there are two cache lines where the data could end up, and now I have to decide where. Ah, did you spot the difference? A second arrow just appeared, which means it could be placed in any of those. The interesting thing is, oh, it's moving. The interesting thing is, I haven't changed these slides in the past 5 years, at least not these with the animations, because I hate animations. And in the past 5 years, it's always been fast enough, so I'm really now at a loss why this is suddenly so slow. So, as I said before, in this case we now have to search some more cache lines, namely these two, to figure out if some data is already in the cache or not. And just as for the fully associative cache, this searching may take some time, and I need more hardware, and more importantly, I should store somewhere which data I did put in there, so I can recognize it later on. And this is what we use the tag field for. So actually, we need some extra RAM to store this data. Basically, what we store there is part of the main memory address. Okay, what we'll now do on the next slides is we'll try to establish a deeper understanding of how the mapping from main memory to the cache addresses works. Basically, it's not difficult. We will always split the main memory address into different parts, and the size of these parts will differ for the different types of cache organizations we will see. So, if this is my main memory address, and this is basically a bit field, there are a couple of parts which I have to cut off. The first, or the least significant part, is the word address, which consists of W numbers of bits. The word address is used to identify the word within the cache line, because the cache line itself may consist of multiple words. And for instance, for x86, or PCs, cache line, as I said last week, I think, is, at least on Intel machines, always 64 bytes. So how many bits would I need for the word address? Yeah, exactly, 6. Because 2 to the power of 6 is 64. Okay, so what's next is another field which we will be calling R, which is used to identify the cache set or the cache block for direct mapping. And the remainder, which if we assume this is S bits in total, this would be S minus R, actually minus W. This is a tag, and I always have to store the tag. Okay, so does this add up? Yeah, so actually in the slides here, this minus W is missing, sorry. Okay, yeah?
I think it's explained as S is only the tag plus the line. But I think on these slides, the word isn't included. Sleep, they have the same slides in Echner Architecture, and it's how DeepMind explained it.
Well, in that case, it doesn't add up, doesn't it? But because if I add 8 to 14, I still only have 22. Because it says here.
Address plus the word are 24. The two from the word aren't counted for S plus R.
Ah. Okay, that's interesting. So S is just 22 in this case. Mm. Okay, so that's an easy way to fix the slides. I just changed the blackboard. Thanks. So. As you may see now, we are reusing parts of the contents of our lectures. That's not because we are lazy. Well, that's one reason, but simply because they have they cover similar content. We cannot always assume that everyone has listened to the same lectures. Or we could, but that would create a lot of dependencies, and then everyone would have to walk through these dependencies, and that would be about as bad as installing a Linux system where you have to walk through all dependencies just to install X or Emacs or whatever. Okay, so let's continue. We will try to have a practical example for the remaining mapping strategies. In this case, we assume that we have 16 megabytes of main memory. May I ask you guys how much RAM your first computer had?
16.
16 megabytes? Okay, excellent. So it's your computer. Okay, anyone else?
512.
Okay, that's good.
Megabytes.
This notebook has now 16 gigabytes. So it times changed. I think my first PC had 768 kilobytes. So, yeah, times change. So for this machine, it's sufficient to have 24 bits for the main address, for the memory address. And we will assume that our cache is 64 kilobytes and a cache line is 4 bytes. So in this case, we just need 2 bits for the word address because it's just, it's just 4 bytes, right? So how large does this line address have to be? We know that the cache is 64 kilobytes. Each line is 4 bytes. So now we have to figure out how many lines there are. I hate it when slides are so full because then you can never figure out anything. So basically, we just have to divide 64k by 4, and that's, of course, 16k or 2 to the power of 16? No, 2 to the power of 14? Yeah. And this is why the line address here is 14 bytes. So finally, the remainder, the remaining 8 bits, that's our tag field. So what I tried to say before is this 64 kilobyte is a bit misleading because we also have to store the tag field, and the tag field is essentially also RAM, which we need in the cache. So what we also need to store is 16k times 8 bits, or we need another 16 kilobytes of RAM for the tag field. This is often forgotten. Actually, in older computers, you could in older computers, you could insert special tag RAM onto the mainboard to extend the usable size of your cache, because tag RAM was expensive. So mainboard manufacturers tried to save on that, and so you had to pay extra to extend your cache. Today, this is not possible any longer because cache is always on chip. Okay, so what's the consequence of this simple mapping? As we said before, main memory is always assigned to exactly one cache line. There is no lookup logic. We cannot confuse where any memory block will be placed. What we also need to check is the tag field. The good thing is no two blocks can have the same tag field. This should be actually true for any mapping strategy, unless we consider one cache set. Within the cache set, we could have the same tag field. Okay. Now let's move on. Oh yeah, this is another graphical representation of how direct mapping works. This is a more mathematical mapping. So what we can see here is, let's assume we have m cache blocks or cache lines in our cache. Then we know that the first cache line may belong to main memory block 0, m, 2m, and so on. The next cache line may belong to memory block 1, m plus 1, 2m plus 1, and so on. Does anyone know what the value of m is expressed by the variables we already have? M should be 2 to the power of r, because basically we have 2 to the power of r cache lines for direct mapping. Okay, now this is a schematic overview how such a cache could be built. What we have here is the cache itself, data plus tag. As I said before, we cannot exclude the tag from the hardware itself. And what we need to do is, if we want to look up data in the cache, we need to feed parts of the address. A word address is used to address data within the cache. We need the first S minus R bits to compare with the tag, and we need these R bits to figure out which cache line we are looking at actually. So, and we need a comparator which compares the tag itself to which tag we are putting in. Only if the tag matches, we can declare a cache hit. Any questions? It's basically really simple. The extensions we would see on the next slides is mainly that we'll need more comparators, more compare logic. And this is also a reason why the fully associative cache won't be used, at least in most architectures, because it's simply too expensive. Okay, a quick summary for direct mapping. It's simple. Most simple solutions in computer architecture are also cost-effective because they need very little hardware, at least for many use cases. High-performance computing is often a bit different, and this is why expensive server chips, for instance from Intel, have much larger caches than consumer chips. It simply pays off to have larger caches for certain use cases. Address length, as we said before, is S plus W. Okay, so here it is corrected. S plus W bits. You don't have to learn all this by heart. All this data is basically just knowledge you could also fetch from Wikipedia. What I would like you to know in the exam is you should be able to explain how such cache placement strategies work. You don't have to know all the numbers. Okay, so one problem with the direct mapping is because the mapping strategy is so simple, I will quite often have cache thrashing. Cache thrashing means parts of my cache are often replaced by new data, and this is often something I don't want because sometimes I would like to reuse the data that just got thrown out of the cache. One solution to this is a victim cache. Victim cache sounds gruesome, but it's really just a secondary cache which is used to keep track of data which was just replaced. So victim cache reduces the consequences in case of a miss. Basically what we do is whenever data gets evicted from our cache, we put it into the victim cache and we assume the victim cache is fully associative, so it can hold at least the past. Depends on how large it is. If we have a very small victim cache, the last 4 to 16 cache lines which we have replaced. There's another way to implement a victim cache. In this case, if I have an additional cache, this can be expensive because I have additional logic which I need to call. AMD has a different solution for the victim cache problem. They do not, as far as I know, add another cache. But they simply say, okay, all data which gets replaced from a higher level gets moved to a lower level in the cache. So all data that gets spilled from level 1 cache gets moved to level 2 or level 3 cache. And because those caches are much larger, they can usually hold much more data. That's basically not a problem because not too much data from these caches will then get evicted. That's okay. The problem with that is that we get a lot more cache traffic. Sometimes it makes more sense to evict data from level 1 cache directly to main memory, depending on how the cache is being used. Okay, so I said before that to explain the N-set associative cache, we will first need to explain the direct mapping, which we just had a look at, and the fully associative cache. The main difference between direct mapping and fully associative is before I could place my data only in one cache line in the cache, now I can place it in any cache line. So the result is I will need a lot more tag. Basically, what happens is this part, I only have 0 bits for R. So all which is left from my address is either word address or tag field. That's the consequence of direct mapping. What happens now is I need a lot more logic here for comparison, because suddenly I need to take a look at any tag field. And it's not just that I need a lot of logic, because usually I can't afford the die space. The problem is this also means that the logic needs a lot of runtime, because the pathways for the signals will be very long. And this is often what I can't afford. I cannot afford to wait for all comparators to finish the logic, even if their runtime is just growing logarithmically with the number of cache blocks. So, as I said before, the address structure here is basically just a tag field and the word address. Because I only have a single cache set, I need 0 blocks for identifying the cache set. Are there any questions for direct mapping? Good. So, N-way associative caches. How do they work? As I said before, it's a combination of both previous strategies. I will separate the cache into multiple sets. Let's extend this cache a bit. So in fully associative mapping, I would be able to place, let's say, this main memory block in any of these 8 cache lines. But for fully associative mapping, I would now split this cache into, let's say, 4 sets. And now, depending on the main memory address, each block could be in two cache lines, either here or here or here or here. So the result is I only need to take a look at most two cache lines to find out if my block was contained in the cache or not. We will have a more detailed example in the slides, I hope without animations. So in this figure, we assume that we have a three-way associative cache. I do not know any architecture which implements that because it's mostly in a power of two, which is reasonable because if you build logic, it's easier to build a compare tree for powers of two. Okay, in this example, we will have a 32-bit main memory address, 64 cache lines. So we'll need a 6-bit index because 2 to the power of 6 is 64. And each will contain a 4-byte cache line. Oh, it is an animation, I'm sorry. Ah, okay. So because we have a 4-byte cache line, we will again need a 2-bit word address. As we said before, we will need a 6-bit cache index. And the remainder is the tag field. This is not right. Okay, let's try to explain this now. I hope that the animations have now displayed all the content and we are not missing anything. So how does it work? We said before we need 6-bit for the index. This is what we'll use in this decoder to select one of the cache sets. Each cache set has two entries and subsequently this is actually the data and two tag fields, and we will need to, after addressing the correct cache set, we will need to forward both cache tags to a comparator, and we will need also to feed to this comparator our tag field from the address we are looking for in the cache. And only if the tag field in the cache set we've just addressed and the tag field which we are looking for matches, only then the cache can declare a hit. I think this illustration should also make clear why it is so difficult to build caches with a higher degree of associativity. If we were needing, let's say, a 4-way associative tag cache, we would need 4 comparators, and we would need 2 levels of OR gates to combine the result. That is assuming our logic only allows for 2 inputs per OR gate. Any questions regarding the N-way associative cache? We will have a more painful example on the following slides. Another animation. Maybe you should speed up the recording afterwards. I don't even know how to skip the animations because otherwise I would, anyway. So, as we've seen in the previous slides, an N-way associative cache requires N comparators. This is one part of the increased cost of the logic. Direct mapping just needs one comparator. The reason for that is it's just one-way associative, so that is to be expected. A fully associative cache needs as many comparators as there are cache lines. Sometimes, even after 5 years, I encounter parts of the slides which don't exactly make sense to me. So the lowest in fully associative cache, but slowly and expensive. Ah, so it refers to the previous line. So in fully associative caches, we have the fewest cache conflicts. We'll see which types of conflicts we can have in caches on the following slides. What we have in modern processors are 2 to 8-way associative caches. That's different for Intel and AMD. AMD typically has caches structured in a way that each cache level has the same amount of cache sets, so the degree of associativity increases the lower we get. The level 2 cache has a higher degree of associativity than level 1 cache, and level 3 cache has a higher degree of associativity than level 2 cache. For Intel, it's different. They typically have the same degree of associativity per cache, but each cache would just have more cache sets. Okay, so let's skip this. Now, cache replacement strategies. When I'm filling my cache, I will at some point encounter the problem that some data is already contained in the cache, and I would like to place new data into the cache. And I have to decide which data gets thrown out, which do I get to keep in the cache. And depending on my strategy, depending on my use case, different strategies might be useful. Okay, another problem before replacing data in the cache is actually how do I keep consistency? The first strategy is write through. So whenever I put data in one level of my caches, I should propagate it to lower levels of the cache, which is of course expensive because I might be writing through data which would never be moved to any lower level of cache because it would be overwritten before. Or I could have a write back strategy, which means I won't update before I'm replacing the content of my cache. The problem with write back is often I don't have a clear way to ensure consistency in the case of a multiprocessor system, because in that case, other cores would have to snoop into higher levels of the cache within a remote core. I'm just thinking, I think most Intel designs use write back. Some AMD designs use wipe through. The reason why they are doing this is for AMD, they often have different cache levels on the same bus, so they can simply broadcast data to all caches simultaneously. Okay, so to this slide now applies what I said before. If I have a cache collision, I'm trying to put data into the cache at a point where all cache lines are already occupied. I have to figure out which data I get to keep and which gets moved out. Okay, for direct mapping, this problem doesn't really exist because I have 0 degrees of freedom. So I will just replace the data on the cache line which I've just computed. For associativity, there are different strategies. I could say, let's use least recently used. The oldest data which I haven't used gets thrown out. Least frequently used would be a bit more, I would assume least frequently used is a bit more intelligent. It doesn't have to be more intelligent depending on the use case. The main problem with LFU is this is really hard to compute because I would then need to keep track of how long data is in the cache and how often it was used and then compute the ratio of both, which involves a division, and divisions are always nasty. So the next strategies would be first in, first out. Does not sound very intelligent or pseudo-random. We Germans usually say pseudo or pseudo or whatever. In German, in English it is pseudo. You just ignore the P. So we could use just some simple stupid random number generator to select at random which data gets moved out. This sounds like the most stupid idea ever, right? We'll see that this is surprisingly good. Now, of course, how good a cache is depends on the use case. You can't really come up with a table which assesses the performance of different replacement strategies for just any code. But the authors of the book we are citing here, Hennessy and Patterson, still did it. And of course, you can now argue that there are use cases where these figures or these numbers will look very differently, but they took 10 different benchmarks from the spec suite. And it is surprising to me that we have very similar performance values. So you never see that any performance number here deviates by more than, I think, 25%. You would assume that pseudo-random is so stupid that it would just be half as fast as a more intelligent strategy. But what we actually see is that random is very close to the other performance levels. So actually, if we compare strategies with each other, the highest deviation here is just a couple of percent. The higher deviations we see are caused by the size of the cache, not by the replacement strategy. So it looks almost as if the replacement strategy, even though it looks like something you should write a dissertation about, doesn't really count. I'm not sure, but I think most vendors do not disclose how the replacement strategy in the cache actually works. So at least for NVIDIA, we don't know it. I think also AMD and Intel don't disclose it. Okay. Any questions on cache replacement? No, so let's move on. Another animation. Maybe I have to reboot the virtual machine, which is running a PowerPoint. But I'm afraid it wouldn't boot again, so I won't try now. Okay, so I said before that there are different types of cache misses. Basically, this is we had hazards for instruction scheduling. For caches, we have cache misses. We can classify those as compulsory, capacity, and conflict. Compulsory means I'm reading data which has never been read before from main memory. So this is a cache miss I cannot avoid, because at some point I have to read it. So this is why this is called compulsory. You cannot avoid this type. Capacity means I have a full cache. I don't have any more space in the cache to put my new data. So this is actually, I've run out of cache space. And this is why it's called capacity miss. The difference between a capacity miss and a conflict miss is I might have still empty parts of a cache, but because my cache is not fully associative, the data which I'm trying to put into the cache is moved to a cache set, and this cache set is full. So I have a cache conflict, even though I would have more capacity. That's the difference between both. Although I have to say that if you're really running a program and you're looking at the individual memory accesses, it's very difficult to say after the computer has been running for a couple of hours to say which type of cache miss that is, because basically every part of the cache has been every part of the main memory has been accessed at least once. Okay, But that does not stop us from creating an intelligent graph where we'd like to figure out how the associativity and the size of the cache, the cache hit rates, and the types of conflicts or of faults in the cache interact. I think there should be, yeah. Oh, sorry. Okay, so what we can see is the larger we make the cache, the less the miss rate gets. The miss rate is probably something like 1 divided by the size of the cache. What we can also see is for very small caches, the degree of associativity matters a lot. So for instance, if I have just a 4 kilobyte cache, it makes sense to have it to have a high degree of associativity. The larger the cache gets, the less this is of importance. So for instance, if I take a look here at these caches, in absolute numbers, it doesn't really matter. It would be interesting to plot this differently to see if the relative performance of a one-way associative and an eight-way associative or a fully associative cache are still the same as here. But in absolute miss rates, it doesn't really matter for larger caches. What you can also say is we get a lot of we can estimate the number of conflict misses by comparing the different degrees of associativity. Capacity misses are only the only type which we can see in the fully associative cache, at least if we ignore compulsory misses. But you don't have to learn this by heart. That's not something I will ask in the exam. Now, any questions for the theory of cache placement? Because now I would like to try to go through an example. And this example is actually very close to what we're doing in the exercises and very close to how many kernels in supercomputer programs look like. So we assume we have 2 matrices, which are 64 by 64 elements. We will be using single precision floating point numbers because those floating point numbers are always 4 byte large. That's convenient to compute in the next on the next slides. We will assume a row major memory layout. Does anyone know what row major memory layout means? Yeah, that's exactly the way. Let's assume this is my matrix, then this is the first address, and we are storing the following elements directly after that. And let's assume this is n times n in size. So this would be address 0, this would be address n, 2n, and so on. And a column major would mean that I'm assuming that the first column gets stored in a row. The second column would start address n, 2n, and so on. Actually, most codes, I think, use row major layout, and they just assume the matrix is transposed when they are not using that layout. Okay, we assume that matrix A will start at address 100 hexadecimal and B is stored at 4000 hexadecimal. So I'm using this OX. Some of the animation speeds up when I'm moving the mouse, which really should not be. Anyhow, so this is all the way I'm using to distinguish decimal numbers from hexadecimal numbers. What I'm now trying to compute is, I'm not trying to update matrix B in dependency of matrix A. And I would like to average always 4 elements. This code is not correct. That's good to see. Okay, so I'm accessing 5 elements, and I should multiply it by 0.2, because that's equal to dividing it by 5. And also here, the x is missing. So to explain it differently, I'm trying to update this matrix. And I would like to compute a very simple stencil code. And let's say to update this element x, y, I will need its 4 neighbors in the cardinal directions. So this is x, y minus 1, simply one element to the top. This would be x, y plus 1. This is x minus 1. This is x plus 1. And I'm adding all 5 elements, including the center, and I should multiply it by 1/5. But in this case, I'm multiplying it by 1/4, which does not change the cache behavior. So for this example, it doesn't matter. If you're writing a scientific code, it's very unlikely that it looks like this with the same coefficient. Okay. So in this example, we are assuming that a cache line is 16 bytes. So I can be sure that always 4 floating point numbers will fit into the same cache line. And we are assuming that my cache is 256 bytes in size. So I have 16 cache lines. And we will now compare different cache placement strategies. But what we'll always be using is least recently used. Least recently used is usually too expensive. And I think I once read that Intel is using a so-called pseudo least recently used replacement strategy. How this works actually, they do not disclose, but they say it's somehow different to least recently used. As I said before, least recently used is also difficult to compute because I have to keep track of at which point in time the data was last accessed, which sounds more expensive than storing cache tag, and the cache tag is already expensive enough. So I'm not sure how they store this, but somehow they manage it. They probably have more people worrying about cache replacement strategies than we have people here in the room. So it makes sense to assume that they came up with some clever idea. Okay, and we will now compare a fully associative cache versus a direct mapping cache versus a two-way set associative cache for a very small excerpt from the code. Here comes the code. We'd like to update a couple of elements. We are assuming that this starts with address 0, so we are updating B14. That would be 0, 1, 2, 3, 4. I'm still waiting for the animation. Okay, let's assume that we are updating just those two elements of the matrix. So we can already assume that we'll also need the two elements above, one element to the left, two elements to the bottom, and one element to the right. So this is basically what we'll need to read from matrix A. And we'll need to update those two elements in matrix B, if PowerPoint shows us the next slide, which I really hope for. It's not doing anything. Which is really bad because, okay, I can at least escape the virtual machine. Okay, I think we'll need to reboot the machine, I'm sorry. I never had that problem before. Yeah, I should have done that before. That would also have gotten me rid of the animations. The reason why I did not do that, I did do that in the past terms, was when I encounter a bug in the slides, for instance, a typo, I would like to fix it directly, because if I try to remember it and fix it after the lecture, I usually won't remember it. Okay, here we go. No, what's happening? This is horrible, I'm sorry. At least the animations are now much faster. So I do not dare to enter full screen, but I hope that we'll be able to finish this now. So as I said before, we would like to update these two elements in the matrix. Let's call this matrix A. And we'll need to read this part of the matrix. And let's say this is matrix B. So we'll try to write, 0, 1, 2, 3, 4, these two elements. Okay, we won't focus on the calculations because the calculations are usually much faster than the memory access. So in this case, we'll just take a look at what we are reading from main memory. This is the first element we are reading. So this is element 1, 3. This is the y coordinate, this is the x coordinate. So this is row 1, this is row 0, row 1. This is column 0, 1, 2, 3. So this is the first element we are reading. The next element we'll be reading is on top of the element we are trying to update. So this is the second read. The third read would be... Where's my mouse? So the third element we are reading is here to the right. And finally, we are reading this one and this element. And now let's figure out how this interacts with the cache. Oh yeah, finally, of course, we are issuing a store. This is for the first cell. And now for the second cell we are updating, we are basically having the same load instructions, but just shifted one element to the right. So the Y component will always be the same as in the pattern before, but instead of 3, we will have 4 here. The next elements will be at X offset 5 and 6, and so on. Okay, so how does this interact with the cache? The first example we'll take a look at is the fully associative cache. We need to store 28 bits for the cache, for the tag. We don't need any bit for the set because we basically just have a single set. And 2 to the power of 0 is 1. So that's one cache set. And we need 4 bits for the word address because each cache line is 16 bytes. Now, as we go through the instructions, the first load means we are loading these values into the cache, which correspond to these elements in the matrix. I hate you. I'm not sure what to hate more, Windows or Java. Probably both. Okay, so as I said, the first load instruction gives me the first cache line. Unfortunately, this cache line won't be ever reused because there's just a single element from the cache line which I need, namely this. The next. Okay, so this is the miss. The next instruction. I'm not sure what happened to the slides because I did not introduce these animations. Perhaps it's because in the last years we always took a look at the PDF. Okay, so I promise next week we'll take a look just as at the PDFs. This is really bizarre. Okay, so the next instruction is also a miss because what I'm now reading is these four elements here. And also I think I need colored chalk for next week so we can see more on the blackboard. So I have just read these. Reading this block is actually very good because I will be needing this element as well. So there's a hope that we'll be reusing this block here. Okay, next read means I'm now reading this block here. And it is, of course, the fourth load instruction is, of course, also a miss because I'm reading this block here. Now, chances are that we'll have a hit for the next read. Because what I'm reading here is, what I'm reading here is essentially this address. And because I read this address first and it belongs to the same cache block, I can have a hit here. And the next access is a store. Store is again a miss. But yeah, because I did never access this block of main memory. This is in matrix B. This is why the address here starts with a 4. This is actually a compulsory miss. So next access will be a read again. I think we'll be reading this one here first. So what do you think will it be a hit or will it be a miss? The next read access. Should be a hit because all we'll be reading for the next update is already contained in the cache. So if our cache doesn't do anything stupid, all following read accesses should be a hit. And exactly, the next read was a hit. So the next read afterwards is again a hit. And the following three reads should again be hits. So, third hit. Okay, so what we have in total, if we look at all instructions, should be we have in total 10 loads, 2 stores, and we just have 5 misses. We'll see a table with the summary later on. If the animations continue in the direct mapping example, I'll take the liberty to export the slides to PDF first because we'll save time. Okay, so let me export those first. A colleague of mine recently said that he likes using PowerPoint for his slides because it's easier than to put them in LaTeX. I would say it's also more unpredictable. That's good. Okay, I like it. So the previous example, let's dot down what the result was from the direct mapping code. Sorry. In the fully associative benchmark we just had, we had 5 misses. Let's see how the direct mapping cache works. For the first read, we will again read these 4 elements. This is again a compilatory miss. We had this miss before. The next read will again be a miss. That's to be expected, because now we are essentially reading these elements. So the next element we'll read will be, I think, this one. No, I'm sorry. It is this one which we are reading. It's again a miss because we have never read it before. But what should be striking now is that even though I had 3 reads, I only have 2 data blocks in my cache. And the reason for that is because I'm using a direct mapping cache, and my matrices are badly sized. I have the first cache thrashing. Basically, this block here has replaced this one. And this is bad, because I would like to reuse this block again. But although I would like to reuse this block again, also, it has just replaced this one. So that's probably not what I had in mind when I designed the cache. The next read does again a replacement, and it's the same cache line. So first I read this one, it got replaced by that one, this one got replaced by that one. So if I'm now reading as next element this one, I will again have to replace that part of the cache. So after 4 reads, sorry, after 5 reads, I still have just 2 blocks in my cache, and I didn't have any cache hits so far because I'm always replacing data. Now the next store, I am afraid, operates on the same cache line. So I'm again replacing data. This sounds perhaps like a constructed example. Of course, it was constructed to show many cache collisions or much cache thrashing. But in reality, you can also see this on a real CPU. The problem is, sometimes if your matrix has the size of a power of 2, you will also see this thrashing. If you did the first series of exercises, some of you may have seen that whenever a 1D array has a size of a power of 2, you will see some drops in performance. So before the last exercises, we said that the curve for the first series of exercise we are expecting might look like something like this, where this is the performance measured in gigaflops, and this is the array size. But in reality, what we will often see is some spikes which go very close to 0. And depending on your architecture, these negative impacts may be more pronounced or less pronounced. The older your architecture is, usually the more pronounced these are. And they are usually always at powers of 2. So the more modern your architecture is, at least for Intel designs, the more graceful it will cope with those cache thrashing effects. So we can now continue all the following instructions, but what we won't see in this example is actually a cache hit, because always data which I'm putting into the cache is being replaced. So even after the last instructions, no cache hit has occurred. So direct mapping means12 misses in total. 5 reads per element, 1 write. So that's 6 misses per element. Because I'm updating 2 elements, this should be 12 misses. Okay, next example, two-way associative cache. Still rather simple to design, because I just have 2 cache lines per cache set. Let's see how this fares. The first load again is a miss, that's what I'm expecting. The next load again is a miss, those are compulsory misses. Because I have 2 lines per cache set now, the next block gets placed here, not here. Okay, the next miss again is a compulsory miss. I'm putting it into the same cache set. Very similar to the direct placement example before, but in this case I'm not immediately evicting the previous read. So in the next read again is a compulsory miss. In this case, I did read this block before, then I did read that one. Now I'm reading this one and I'm replacing that one because it's least recently used. Not good, but better than the previous example. So in the next read, I'm now reading this element. I have a cache hit because this block here is still in the cache. That's good. One hit, wow. The next store will replace some part of the data. This is where I had the hit before. Did I have the hit there? I think I should have replaced actually this data here on the next slide, but it doesn't matter too much for the example now. So the next store is again a miss because I did not access matrix B before, and so on and so on. The problem here is I have a lot of collisions still in this cache set because almost all my data is contained in this cache set. But it's less collisions than before, and at least I have 2 hits here. So 2 hits means 10 misses. So what we can say is we had a table before which tried to assess the cache hit rate for different replacement strategies. And basically what the table said from the book of Hennessy and Patterson is it doesn't really matter which replacement strategy we are using, because the highest difference in cache hit rates is just a couple of percent. But what we can see here is for very specialized codes like 2D stencil code, which we just took a look at, we can say that direct placement may be as bad as having 0 hits, while fully associative cache may exhibit 0 conflicts and a lot more hits. So for this example, the replacement strategy in our cache and the placement strategy really matters. Okay, so we are not really done with this lecture with the time, but actually this is all I prepared for today. We have finished caches, and so in the next lecture we will move again one level up and we'll take a look at multi-core designs and how architectures for those have changed. Thank you very much for being here. See you tomorrow at the exercises.